UK Wine Show, show number 24 for the 10th of November. Harvest Report with Ridgeview. G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 24 for the 10th of November. This week we're going to be interviewing Mike Roberts from Ridgeview. Ridgeview are a sparkling wine specialist, and in their maiden vintage 1996, they were voted England's top wine. Since then, they've won lots of accolades, including the IWSC Top English Wine for 3 times. The Queen even gave it to Jack Chirac. We're going to be talking to Mike about the Harvest Report, also a wee bit about how they make their wines and what he's trying to do. They have a very French champagne way of looking at sparkling wine. But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. The 2006 UK wine harvest looks set to produce an excellent vintage. English producers were upbeat about the results, although this year's weather has brought some anomalies. Ridgeview winemaker and director Mike Roberts told us there are 2 consistent reports among producers here. The first is a problem with botrytis, the fungal disease that affects almost ripe or damaged grapes. The second is low acidity, and it's important to have good acidity levels when making quality sparkling wines. Ridgeview pressed their biggest harvest ever using a new Coquard press, as used by all the top champagne houses. Knightimber, which last week was crowned UK Wine Producer of the Year, was also happy with the harvest. Paul Woodrow Hill, the vineyard manager, told us the quality was very good and 2006 could be a very good vintage on a par with some of the best. Knightimber started picking a week early on the 9th of October because the acidity levels in the grapes were dropping quickly. Chapel Down winemaker Owen Elias told us the quality of the harvest was very good with high volumes. Picking started 2 weeks early and some growers have only just finished. Meanwhile, the world's most influential wine critic, Robert Parker, has hired a little-known English writer to comment on wine from a UK perspective. An Essex boy, for goodness sake, as Neil Martin puts it on his own website, will be joining erobertparker.com before Christmas. Neil started his site, winejournal.com, 3 years ago with no experience of writing. For the first month, just he and his mum visited the site each day. But last month, the website received over 130,000 visitors. Neil told us that working with Robert Parker is what you would call a dream job. He also hopes that the move might wake up a few people who have had their heads stuck in the sand when it comes to the quality of writing on the internet. He is looking forward to inflicting his humour on the American public and believes wine writing should encapsulate the job of drinking wine rather than just being serious all the time, irrespective of whether it's Chilean Merlot or Petrus. And finally, a Croatian grape has been found to be genetically identical to both California's Zinfandel and Italy's Primitivo. Joel Peterson from Ravenswood Wines told us that Dr. Carol Meredith of the University of California has figured out how to analyse grapes to determine where they come from. She has used this data to look at Zinfandel. It is believed that the Croatian grape went across the Adriatic to Italy in the early 18th century and California in 1854 via Austria. According to Joel, the Croatian grape looks slightly different to Primitivo due to its more uneven ripening, which is closer to Zinfandel. But he explained that it makes sense, based on everything we can determine genetically, that California's version is probably from Croatia, as is Italy's. They've been separated a long time and been selected for different things, so they look different. But basically, they are clonal variations of the same grape. And that's it for the news this week. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks for that, Jane. Probably the most interesting thing I thought was about the Zinfandel grape coming from Croatia. I've always thought it was Primitivo, which is the Italian grape variety. But it sort of gives you a background into some of the movements of grapes. We always think of Italy having a load of its own native grapes. But in actual fact, they probably did come from other regions as winemaking spread throughout Europe. Next up, we're going to have the interview with Mike Roberts. Hi, I'm here with Mike Roberts, the winemaker and director of Ridgeview. How are you, Mike?
I'm very well indeed, thank you, especially on a sunny day like this.
It is a nice day, isn't it? The leaves in the vine have just turned brown.
I have to say that the leaves have stayed on after harvest longer than normal, and the last frosts of the last couple of days will probably take their toll of the leaves as soon as the wind comes up, but it's looking lovely and golden.
Beautiful.
A few days of real colour.
How did you get into wine, Mike? You're not originally a wine man. You came from the IT industry, didn't you?
I came from the IT industry in 1993. I sold my IT business to a computer manufacturer, and we then decided that we needed something else to get into. So I'm reminded that for many decades before that, I've said time and time again, I really would like a vineyard. And so when this piece of land came up, I looked at it and said, God, that would make a lovely vineyard. And away we went.
What year was that?
93, 94. The beginning of 94, in fact, really.
And that's this land here, is what, 30 acres?
We've got 30 acres here at this moment in time, of which 16 acres are planted with vines. But in addition to that now, we actually have a couple more estates that we're looking at that we have planted up in last year and this year. And that takes us up now to 30 net acres of vines of our own domain, as we call it, although we do have somewhere approaching 50 acres now planted up by other people.
Are they farmers who you've told, look, plant these clones?
Yeah, I would actually say that with each of those, we work as very much as a partnership where we give help and advice, having been through it ourselves a couple of times, on what to plant, how to plant it, organising the supply of vines and materials. And we do that. And then we come to an arrangement by which we process their grapes, change for part of their crop, and or, in fact, commitments to buy, one or the other.
So you started Ridgeview in 93.
When
did you get your first crops coming off the vines?
Well, we actually managed a vineyard for a couple of years. So our very first vintage was in 96, which in fact contained only the tiniest element of Ridgeview wine itself. The other came from a vineyard over in Faversham that we managed. And I have to say, we immediately ran the best English wine in that year with that wine. The maiden crop here was in fact in 97, where after taking off, I nearly cried to see it being taken off, but a green harvesting of something about half of our crop.
That's where you just take off the
green, set berries, so that you've got, you don't strain the plants too much.
Yeah,
but we had about a half a crop.
Yeah.
And of course, in fact, they came up absolutely magnificent with wonderful sugars and beautiful grapes.
And now this year, one of the top sparkling wines, your Bloomsbury.
Well, Bloomsbury has been very successful. It's about what we call our signature wine, Chardonnay dominant wine, 60% Chardonnay. And it has won more trophies. It's actually our least expensive wine, but it is our signature wine, and we put a lot of effort into making sure it's as good as possible. Last year, of course, we took the IWSC trophy for best sparkling wine. That's worldwide, of course. And we've won with it on the IWSC trophy for best English wine three times, and the UK international competition three times. It's a significant amount of trophies that Bloomsbury has taken with.
I read that you give it a bit of oak ageing in old oak barrels.
We try to oak a very small proportion, really, probably less than 10%. And it will vary, but generally we would oak a bit of Chardonnay for a few months in used barrels. Although in 2005 and again now in 2006, we have got some new barrels. So we're doing, and we've increased the number. So we're now doing much more of a proportionate aging with some oak that's been 2 years old, some oak that's new, some oak that's 4 or 5 years old. We then add roughly 5%, I suppose. It's to add a different layer. We're looking, you know, the heart of a champagne style, if I can use that terminology, is to blend. You know, it is the assemblage in champagne is important. And blending different clones, different varieties, of course, the three varieties in different proportions, reserve wines, not reserve wines, fresh wines, older wines, and then something like oak as well, all adds little layers of dimensions of flavour profiles. We think it's very important.
What are you trying to achieve by putting it in the oak? It's obviously adding some complexity to the wine, but
well, the other,
how does it change the wine?
Compared to Knightinbridge, for example, we make in a very reductive way. We do make wines which stay fresh for a very long time. But one of the attitudes of champagne lovers is to like some of that oxidation that develops. And, of course, a little bit of ageing in oak does aid just a slight hint of oxidising in the wine. It's very small, the quantities we use, but of course that's part of the process.
How did the 2006 harvest shape up, Mike?
Well, it's a fabulous harvest. I was delighted that we had our new press in, our new Coquard press.
Oh, I've heard about that. That's the first one in the UK, isn't it?
First Coquard in the UK, yes. It's handwritten on the side, it's number one Angleterre. And it's a beautiful press. I mean, as Coquard, I mean, Coquard's client list looks like anybody that's who's who in Champagne, of course. So we're delighted to have it, and by God, we needed it this year too, because we pressed our biggest harvest ever, and one of our growers came on stream for the first time as well. So we certainly had the biggest harvest with more land coming on stream as well. We certainly had plenty to press, and it did a lovely job. The quantity was very good this year. We had to chase Botrytis out of the vineyard in September because it was so warm, yet it was so damp.
Yeah.
So there are reports throughout the UK of people losing a lot of Botrytis, Pinots in particular. We did certainly lose some, but from a very large crop, it really didn't notice too much on the quantity side.
Did you do a lot of preventative spraying?
Well, we spray as much as we can reasonably do. Obviously, there comes a point in September in particular when there's very little to use. I mean, you're within the harvest
periods,
times,
yeah.
And so on. So you really have to rely on making sure you're getting as much air as possible to dry the berries and so on, and a bit of prayer, perhaps. But spraying becomes pretty difficult. The result is that, in fact, we've got wines which tremendous heat in July has created an anomaly which we haven't seen before, which certainly Champagne have been experiencing now for a couple of years, well, for probably a couple of decades, in fact, an increasing pH. And so the pH this year is higher than we've seen in the past. And I was talking to our oenologist in France, and I said that we're used to, as he knows, 2.8, 2.9, 3.1, really very low, which are very fine. That's just what you want for the best champagnes. And all his comment was, well, lucky you, because in Champagne they're averaging 3.2 now, which is the sort of figures we were getting this year, I have to say, because of that hot July. And we would like them a bit lower than that, but otherwise the harvest is fabulous.
So you said your pH levels are a wee bit higher than normal for this year. What about in general for any of the other producers? Have you been speaking to other winemakers in the area?
Yeah, we have. I mean, it's a very good email system, which actually has a lot of, you know, gossip goes around it. It's quite very interesting for us to all sit and gossip on the emails. Yes, the consistent report from this year, two consistent reports from this year. Sometimes an overwhelming problem with Botrytis, but the majority of people have managed to manage the Botrytis down to a reasonable issue. This low acidity and high pHs. To some extent, some people have suffered a bit from significant watering down with the rains in September. That will have created the lower acidity. Although I feel it's more to do with, I mean, our sugar levels were, you know, pretty well perfect. I can't grumble at many of our sugar levels. We want sugars that will give us about 11% alcohol, and yeah, we were getting that. And our acids were just marginally lower, but the pHs were high. But other people are actually reporting significantly low acidity. Maybe they had more rain than we had. I mean, know that we've had drought conditions, and maybe, although the water came down in deluges for a few days and intermittently, much of it may well have just soaked away, or rolled off.
And
so on.
You've got a nice slope here going down, haven't you?
Yeah, so it will tend to roll.
Do you guys do anything other than sparkling wines? You're a sparkling specialist?
That's all we do. We only make sparkling wine. We only make it from the three champagne varieties of Chardonnay, Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier.
Why did you not go down sort of some of the other still wines? I've had some lovely rosés from Chapel Down, Bacchus and Rondeau, great varieties.
Chapel Down, I think, do very well with their still wines, mainly because obviously the majority of their wines are being grown for them. Their own vineyards don't produce huge amounts, nothing like the quantities they make. But it's there is a statement, I think, which is very valid, that the healthiest vineyard is one with a positive cash flow. And it's a very serious problem that, in fact, we do make some really very lovely still wines, but they are not lovely enough. Bacchus is said to be close to Loire and so on, but it's not going to get the premium price that a real Loire Sancerre is going to get. Sure. It may be like Sauvignon Blanc, but it isn't Sauvignon Blanc. And therefore, it's got to be priced, apart from its, if I can say it, you know, because it's a niche an English product, you may be able to get a bit of a premium for it, but it can't get the sort of price that carries it right the way through from the cost of the land, the planting of the vines, and looking after the vines well. You've got to look after the vines well to get the quality that you want, but you don't necessarily get the value. Sparkling wine, champagne is the highest added value wine, perhaps with the exception of sweet wine, which is perhaps something we come back to, because I think we could concentrate on that as well as a nation. Okay. But I think sparkling wine is the, well, frankly, when I looked into plant here, I wanted to plant a vineyard, unlike those people that looked immediately to Germany when, I suppose, they were planting because German wines were the most popular. You know, the only university they'd go to is Giesenheim, or tradition, go to Bordeaux. And there was no Davis or Sturt or Lincoln. So they learnt from the Germans about cloning, learnt about cross-hybriding and so on and so forth, and moved away from the classical varieties. New Zealand learnt their thing when Hunter came over with his Sauvignon Blanc in 83 and showed it to the Sunday Times Wine Club, and from there on, it's rather like finding religion, I think. You know, you re-find classic varieties. And when Nitimba and ourselves have shown the world that, in fact, you know, with those varieties, it's not surprising because it's only 100 kilometres to the south of us. Our nearest appellation is Champagne.
Yeah, I saw on your website you've got a map of the latitudes, and you're down here, you're not actually that far away from Champagne.
No, I mean, in Australia, you know, Mornington Peninsula is further away from the Yarra Valley than we are from Champagne. And it's high added value. We have the same issues as Champagne, that, or benefits in reality, that they're right on the doorstep of a major international capital in Paris. And we are the same here in London. You know, we have a huge market potential here for what we are. We're also in the country, though, that actually imports more Champagne than any other nation.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing.
And you have to add the United States and Germany together before you get to the 37 million that we import. So if any market was there to be attacked, it must be the champagne market. We do want to think of us attacking the champagne market rather than the sparkling wine market.
And is that why you've got a lot of French consultants? You know, you seem to use a lot of champagne people. On your website, you indicate that you follow the rules set out in Champagne in terms of pressings.
Yes, we do indeed. In fact, our new Coquard is programmed hard. It's hardwired, as you might say, to be, you can only press within the champagne parameters. But yes, we do press, because, you know, they make the quintessential sparkling wine. They've taken a long time to develop their set of rules, which, okay, there are some areas of it where they stretch it a bit here and they stretch it a bit there. Yields are being stretched again now and so on. But maybe they ought to be with climate change. You know, they have decided over time that they had far more varieties, for example, than they have now, but they're honed in on those three varieties because they certainly make wonderful sparkling wine. The real answer to your question is, why reinvent the wheel? If someone's doing something which is renowned worldwide, and we've got all the other similarities, geology, weather, then why not? Why don't we follow them, take the easier route? We don't want to reinvent it necessarily. When we have, in a way, started to establish ourselves as standing shoulder to shoulder with Champagne, we've got all those French certificates on the wall over there. That's French against us. You know, we are in France and lined up with Champagnes and winning silver medals and things, which, we are shoulder to shoulder. Once we establish that credibility, then perhaps we can start to even play around a little bit and create an English variation on it.
Champagne's a good benchmark to hit first,
yes,
though, isn't it?
Absolutely.
A first base position. All right, Mike, I think we'll wrap it up.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Very good.
Hope you enjoyed that interview with Mike. It was a great day down in Ridgeview on the day. We recorded this about 4 or 5 days ago, and the vineyards were looking absolutely fantastic. Lovely golden colours on the vines just before the weather sets in and blows all the leaves away. Next week, we're going to be talking to Oz Clark. Oz is the wine communicator of the year. In fact, he's been the wine communicator of the last couple of years. Very, very nice fellow to talk to. Oz is going to be talking about how he got into wine, his first experiences with wine, and just a wee bit about background about Oz himself. Until then, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show was brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show was produced by Jane Scott and recorded and edited by Chris Scott. The news was read by Jane Scott and researched by Sandra Clement. The music for the UK Wine Show is Griff de Jingle 1 by Marcel de la Jatelle and Silence by Etoile Noire.